From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Well, first of all, congratulations to the Louisville Cardinals, NCAA basketball champs, defeating tonight a tough Michigan team, 82-76. Well, they carried their number one ranking all the way through, and they did it. Next hour, adventurer Robert Young Pelton joins me. And the world we live in. But here's what's happening. Well, more North Korean stories. North Korea will recall 51,000 North Korean workers and suspend operations at a factory complex that it has jointly run with South Korea, moving closer to severing its last economic link with its rival as tensions continue to escalate. The statement comes amid weeks of North Korean war threats and other efforts to punish South Korea and the U.S. for ongoing joint military drills. Distrust of the Federal Reserve and concern that the U.S. dollar may become worthless, fueling a push to more than a dozen states to recognize gold and silver coins as legal tender. Lawmakers in Arizona are poised to follow Utah, which authorized bullion for currency in 2011. Similar bills are advancing in Kansas, South Carolina, and other states. The measure, backed by the limited government Tea Party movement, mostly symbolic. You still can't pay for groceries and gold in Utah, for example. They reflect, though, lingering dollar concerns amplified by the Fed's moves in recent years to try to stabilize the economy. Constantly beeping alarms in hospitals are being linked to patient deaths and other dangers in a new alert. The alarms can lead to what is called noise fatigue, and doctors and nurses sometimes inadvertently ignore the sounds when there's a real patient emergency, possibly resulting in treatment delays that endanger patients. As a matter of fact, a group studying all this says that more than 500 people died each year because of hospital alarms. Can you believe that? A chemical found in red meat may help explain why eating too much meat is bad for the heart, according to U.S. scientists. A study in the journal Nature Medicine shows that the supplement carnitine in red meat was broken down by bacteria in the gut. This kicked off a chain of events that resulted in higher levels of cholesterol and an increased risk of heart disease. Dietitians are warning there may be a risk to people taking carnitine supplements. Dr. John McDougall, author of The Starch Solution. John, I've got to tell you, I take these supplements. Should I stop?
Yeah, absolutely. You should stop. You should stop all supplements, not just L-carnitine. Supplements are not healthy. They create nutritional imbalances. And this one, L-carnitine, is associated with production of a substance that's associated with increased risk of heart disease. But I think the important thing about these studies is it points again that red meat is really an unhealthy food that'll rot your arteries, give you heart attacks and strokes, colon cancer, all kinds of problems. They've just identified another mechanism involved, and that involves the bacteria in the gut. Interestingly, vegans and vegetarians didn't produce that kind of bacteria and didn't produce the extra chemicals that were produced by meat eaters that were associated with more blocked arteries. So there's a very solid message here for people to stop eating meat and to become vegetarians and vegans. I know that sounds drastic, but if you want to protect your heart, you want to protect your colon, you need to do that. Unfortunately, the message some people are going to get out of this article is that you should take antibiotics that kill bacteria in your gut so you can prevent the conversion of the substance in red meat to the harmful substance that damages the arteries. Or they're going to try and invent some other drug that can counteract the effects of eating meat. And that's just the wrong thing. Costs more money, many side effects. Won't answer all the problems. Even if you solve the artery damage, you still have to deal with the colon cancer and the obesity and the type 2 diabetes that you get from eating all this rich red meat. So I hope people learn the right messages from this particular study. Red meat, bad health.
L-carnitine, stay off it, right?
Oh, it's a supplement, a waste of money, damaging to your health, increase your risk of dying of heart disease. Don't do it.
I've been taking it for 3 years, John. Jeez.
No, it's time. I'm working on you, George.
I know.
I'm working on you. I'm making progress.
All right, kid. I'll see you later. But Dr. John McDougall. Former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher has died peacefully at the age of 87 after suffering a stroke while staying at the Ritz Hotel in central London. David Cameron called her a great Brit, and the Queen spoke at her sadness of the death. Lady Thatcher was the Conservative Prime Minister from 1979 to 1990. She was the first woman to hold that role. Ah, that's Annette Funicello singing that song a long time ago. She moved from being a Mouseketeer to a beach party bikini fame with a new generation for selling, for example, peanut butter and gently poking fun at her own image. And in the end, Annette Funicello faced the biggest test of her life, a decades-long battle with multiple sclerosis. With strength and courage, hoping her own experience would help others, the actress, singer, former Mouseketeer has died at the age of 70 years old. Always remember her when I was a kid. I think I had a crush on her, as a matter of fact. Flights across the North Atlantic could get a lot bumpier in the future if the climate changes, as scientists expect, continue. Planes are already encountering stronger winds and could now face, they say, more turbulence, according to research led from the United Kingdom. The study, published in Nature Climate Change, suggests that by the mid-century, passengers will be bounced around more frequently and more strongly. Let's turn to Earth Changes media expert Mitch Batras. What's causing this, Mitch?
Well, hi, George. Great to be with you. Well, it's just a continuation of you know, what we've been seeing for a long time. It's this ongoing battle of what is the cause. Now, they're being very careful in articles like this where they say this is used by supercomputer simulations. And they're very cautious in the words they use. But there is no factual data whatsoever as to the cause. Yes, certainly turbulence can increase by rising warm air. But then again, the sun causes that as well. Mm-hmm. Several natural phenomena can cause that. Whatever causes turbulence, or whenever the jet stream will shift, or there's any atmospheric conditions which do change, certainly will have an effect at lower atmospheres, such as airplanes. But as to the cause, I'd be very cautious in wanting to steer in the direction of global warming and so forth, and also look for clues like this in this article that was released. And I'm quoting, quote, fuel costs money, which airlines have to pay, and ultimately it could be a course that passengers will have to pay more for tickets. Those kinds of things are always red flags to me, and it's really getting difficult, George, to discern, you know, true intelligence with a great amount of integrity of what is truly scientific and what's political.
Well, that's
and I don't
point.
Know if we'll ever be able to get back, at least in the near future, and I'm talking about 20 years out.
Well, the one thing I do know right now, Mitch, we do bounce a lot. When I'm in a plane, I've been bouncing more lately than ever before, so it's going to probably get worse, as this study points out. But as you pointed out, too, I don't think it's just global warming that is the cause. By the way, in November of this year, Comet Ison could become one of the brightest and most active comets in years when it races through the hot atmosphere of the sun. Right now, it's just a little dim speck in the deep freeze of space near the orbit of Jupiter, but it's going to get brighter and brighter as it gets closer and closer. NASA Chief Charles Bolden says the space agency will not be sending astronauts to land on the moon anytime soon. NASA won't lead the way back to the moon in the foreseeable future in order to maintain its focus on manned missions to an asteroid and eventually Mars, Bolden said during a joint meeting of the Space Studies Board and the Aeronautics and Space Engineering Board. So we'll see what happens. But in a moment, Robert Zimmerman joins us. We will be talking with him about NASA not going back to the moon and some other space issues next on Coast to Coast AM. And George Norrie back with you. Robert Zimmerman, award-winning space historian, noted author. He's got a book, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8. We'll talk with you about that a little bit later on. You know, the old song, Everyone's Gone to the Moon, that doesn't include us anymore, Robert. How come? Why aren't we going to go back?
Well, George, thanks for having me here. The issue isn't so much whether we will go back or whether Americans will go back to the moon. The question is really whether NASA and the federal government will have a plan to go back to the moon. And They're not. It's pretty clear over the last 40 years that since the 60s space program, NASA has really not been very effective in accomplishing pretty much anything. Yes, they built the shuttle, and they built the International Space Station, and they got them up in orbit. They got the station up in orbit, and the shuttle was used to build that, and it was a remarkable piece of engineering. But its actual goal of lowering the cost to orbit so that space exploration and the settlement of the solar system would become routine and normal and available to everyone mm-hmm. was absolute failure, total failure. And the same thing in a sense with the space station, because they really have their goals very mixed up with the space station. They're not really focusing on the kind of work that needs to be done to learn how to build interplanetary spaceships. That's what you use a space station for. In that sense, NASA's been very ineffective. And then multiple times in the last 20 years since the shuttle became operational, NASA has tried to develop follow-ups to the shuttle. And every single time, they've spent billions and never completed it. The most recent two attempts, the most recent attempt was the Constellation that was going to replace the shuttle with the Orion capsule. That failed. That was canceled by Obama administration, and he's now created the Space Launch System, which is a different kind of rocket using the Orion capsule, and that's going to cost billions over the next.
And year. Another administration in 2016,
well, canceled.
They could change it. Yeah,
that's right, and that is actually what's happened repeatedly for the last 40 years. So today, you made reference to this. Charles Bolden, administrator of NASA, was at a science conference, and he said basically that. And he does not expect NASA to go back to the moon in his lifetime. And he's absolutely correct. I agree with him. I think others will do it.
What about private companies?
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
We're going to have a whole range of privately financed companies doing it for profit, and they're going to do something like this, and they're going to do it quickly, and they're going to do it efficiently. And the most important thing, George, is they're going to do it often. Something that NASA, of course, has never been able to do. And this is part of this is NASA's actually been helping in this because they have been purchasing services from private companies. But the fact still is that it's the private companies who have been leading the way in this. They've been coming up with new ideas and new designs and new efforts to make a buck in space. And the result of that is we're going to get over the next decade a multitudinous number of companies and ideas and methods for getting humans into orbit. And eventually the profits from that are going to pay for further exploration, which will get us to the moon and beyond. And I don't speak, from a vacuum here. There, the number of companies I could describe to you in detail, George, of what they can do, it can go on for quite a while. I hope we'll talk about some of them because they're really amazing and they're doing some really good stuff and they're making money at this.
That's where did they get the technology, though, to so rapidly advance? Was it because they had former NASA employees?
No. Actually, yes. Well, yes and no. There are some NASA employees that are involved in this. There's no question of that. But what's really going on here is that one of the things that has bogged down the aerospace industry in the United States is a lack of innovation. The technology here is to put rockets into orbit. That's the number one thing, to get payloads into space. That's a very robust industry that's been around now for half a century. This is something we know how to do. But the companies that have existed in the United States, the companies like Boeing and Lockheed Martin that launched the Delta rockets and the Atlas rockets that we've depended upon, have had no interest in innovating. They basically live off the government. Government's not interested in lowering the cost, so they don't bother to lower the cost, and so they have a very expensive way of doing things. What happened in about 6 years ago is that the owner, the guy who invented PayPal, Elon Musk, realized that there was money to be made in the launch industry, that he could, using this robust technology, when there's a lot of good young engineers out there who know how to do it, as well as experienced people as well, that if he started from scratch and didn't follow the patterns of the past and did it as efficiently and as carefully as possible, he could actually produce a rocket that would cost half of what everyone else is doing with no special technology. And this is about 6 years ago. And today, that's exactly what Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, has done. They produced the Falcon 9 rocket, which is a rocket capable of geosynchronous orbit, sending satellites to geosynchronous orbit. They've used it now three times to put a Dragon capsule as a cargo craft to ISS. Falcon 9 rocket uses something called the Merlin engine. That engine is the first American-built, newly designed rocket engine since, essentially, since the shuttle was built. And yet that's not advanced technology. They just simply used modern modern computer technology, some advances we've had now for 40 years of development. But they went back to basics of how do you build a rocket from scratch and how can you do it effectively and cheaply. And they did that. And they've developed this rocket. And it costs half of what everybody else has on the market. And it's therefore causing conniptions with every other launch company because they have to be able to compete with this rocket. And they're having trouble. ArianeSpace, the company that Europe has, the French are the main operators of that. It's a very good rocket, the Ariane 5 rocket, very reliable rocket, but it costs about twice as much. And they realize if they don't do something soon, they're going to lose their market share. Same thing with the Russians' Proton rocket. It costs about 30% more. It's less expensive, but still they can't compete. The Chinese have said we don't know how we can match the prices of Elon Musk. And what this company has done with the Falcon 9 is it set a new standard. It means the cost to getting into orbit will go down. When the cost goes down, new customers pop up everywhere because they can now afford the lower prices. Not only does Elon Musk sell to the NASA, but he all, you know, to provide cargo to ISS and eventually manned capsule to ISS, but he sells it to communications companies worldwide. He has a long manifest. This is a new rocket. It's only 6 years old, and already it's dominating the market. He has a manifest of commercial launches. They're going to start going regularly this year. That's going to pay all the costs. Even NASA cut all the money they're sending him for sending cargo to ISS. He will make enough money to continue development and launch services and the development of the Dragon capsule for manned operations.
Robert, this plan to send a man to an asteroid, astronauts to an asteroid,
yeah.
is that practical? I mean,
it's not a question of practical, George. It's a question of whether or not NASA is going to do it. This is Barack Obama's Kennedy speech. You know, we've had since Kennedy, every president that has followed, practically every president, has tried to duplicate what Kennedy did. Reagan in 84 announced, we're going to build a space station, and we're going to have it up by the end of the decade. Sound familiar? Didn't happen that way. Clinton announced, we're going to build the International Space Station by the end of the decade and do it with the Russians. Well, that did happen. But then George Bush said, we're going to go back to the moon by 2015. That didn't happen. And then Barack Obama announced, no, we're not going to go to the moon. We're going to go to an asteroid by 2025. Well, I don't think it's not going to happen. It's like I mentioned before.
Why do we want to go to an asteroid anyway?
Well, yeah, there are actually good reasons to go. There's good reasons to go to the moon. There's good reasons to go to asteroids. There's good reasons to go to Mars. There's good reasons to go to all these places when you explore the solar system. The people in space are going to need the resources at all those locations, not only for places to live, but for the minerals, the resources, the values that those places will provide. So going to an asteroid is a perfectly good thing. There's lots of good reasons. Study the asteroids because one day a big one might be going to hit the Earth, and the more we know about them, the better chances we have of stopping such a disaster. So there's lots of good reasons to do it. It's just that a presidential announcement, this is what we're going to do, it's not going to happen, and that's not the future of our space program. The future of our space exploration is not going to even be a program. It's going to be a chaotic, competitive operations between many different companies all competing to try to make money from the operations. So if you want to go to an asteroid, you'll pick one company. If you want to go to the moon, you'll pick another company. You'll have lots of choices. That's the future.
And what about Mars?
Well, Mars is eventually down the road. I was once on your show, George, during the period of time when the shuttle was not flying. It was after the Columbia
crash. Right, it was right after
that. And during that interview, you had a guest, one of your listeners called, and he asked me about, what about terraforming Mars?
That's right.
And my answer was, we can't even get people in orbit yet. Why are we talking about terraforming Mars?
You were on with Bob Zubrin then.
Well, it's not a question of, Bob Zubrin's got some good ideas, but in the end, going to Mars is, we're not capable yet in terms of engineering yet to do it. We need to do a lot of work to learn how to build a spaceship that can survive the long journey, that can be maintained far from Earth without help from Earth, and then keep the people alive on that vehicle for more than a year. That's what a space. I wrote a whole book on this. My previous, one of my earlier books, Leaving Earth, was a whole book about how a space station is nothing more than a prototype interplanetary.
Let's talk more about that, Robert, when we come back. We'll get into your latest work too, Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, and we'll take some phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Zimmerman with us. We'll take your calls in a moment. So, Robert, going to Mars could happen. Do you think it will happen?
Oh, there's no doubt it'll happen. I tell you right now, George, I said this in Genesis, the story of Apollo 8. There is no doubt that someday we will colonize the planets. We will terraform Mars. We might even make Venus a place that children can play on. This is going to happen. I have no doubt about it. But it's a question of being aware of what must be done and how to figure out how to do it. You can't go to Mars like nonchalantly. There are several private companies right now, for example, have proposed sending tourists to Mars, and Dennis Tito, the first space tourist, has proposed a nonprofit mission to send a married couple on a flyby of Mars in just less than 5 years. That's all well and good, and I'm not against anyone proposing and trying to do anything like that, but I think realistically we don't have the technology or the engineering or the medical knowledge yet to put a person in a spaceship that we can depend on, that will work for millions and millions of miles and last for more than a year without problems. That's what you need a space station for. You have to learn how to build this technology. That's one of the problems with ISS. We don't focus on that very well at ISS, and it's wasting time and engineering by not doing so. Eventually, we'll get to Mars. I think that a lot of private companies building spaceships and making money with tourism and with launching cargo into space, they will eventually get to a point where they themselves, we have a private company, for example, Robert Bigelow's company, Bigelow Aerospace,
yep,
that is not only building a module to add to ISS right now at a fraction of the cost of what NASA costs to build these things, but they've launched already. Bigelow's launched two prototype modules in orbit. They're still working. And he is designing, his company is designing modules, miniature small space stations that he can launch for any customer who wants one. And people like Elon Musk at SpaceX are interested in that as a product down the road, because once they've got it in orbit, they can sell tickets to people who want to go, from right, scientists to just plain tourists.
Yeah, it's exciting. Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, a great mission back in 1968, and I'll always remember it as an 18-year-old. When they circled the moon on Christmas Eve with that incredible television broadcast.
I wrote Genesis back originally in 1998, George. It was my first book. It's been in print now all those years, but I decided it needs to be out in an e-book, so I just came out with an e-book edition of it, which is kind of good for readers because it's like the hardback. Got all the images, all the color pictures, but it's got a new introduction by me and Valerie Anders, the wife of one of the astronauts, did an introduction. That mission, I wrote this book because I, just like you, George, I was alive when this happened, and I remember how important the Apollo 8 mission was to the United States, both culturally and historically. It really struck me as a kid then how much the country changed from that mission. Much more so than the Apollo 11 landing. The landing was difficult and important and a great achievement, but it wasn't what changed history. What changed history was the Apollo 8 mission, when three astronauts were the first people ever to leave Earth orbit, to go to another world. They will always be the first three people to have done that. And because that was so, I remember how it literally took the nation by the shoulders and shook it. And the culture changed after that mission. So decades later, I realized, you know, people have forgotten this mission, but it's really historically more important. So I wrote a book on it. And the thing about that mission that is many people will remember who lived in it is that they were launched Christmas week. They arrived in lunar orbit on Christmas Eve, and they had a primetime telecast to the world from orbit that night, Christmas Eve. And the astronauts decided in orbit to read from the Old Testament, to read the first 12 verses of the Old Testament from Genesis. And I remember this happening. It was a mind-boggling experience to live through it. I wanted to know, how did that happen? How did they come to the decision to do that? They were freely allowed to do that. And so I wrote the book.
Yeah, without anybody litigating.
What?
Yeah,
you're right, George. Today they you'd get sued and there'd be court cases. And in fact, this is one of the cultural changes. Very shortly afterward, NASA clamped down on astronauts speaking their minds like this. When these guys were getting ready to go to the moon, the public affairs guy in charge at NASA, Julian Scheer, called up Frank Borman, the commander. And he said to Frank Borman, look, you're going to have a telecast Christmas Eve. More people will be listening to you guys than in the history of the human race. You better think of something to say. And this is what's interesting, yeah. George. At that time, Frank Borman said, well, I'm just a jet pilot. What do I know? Can you give me a suggestion? He says to the public relations man. And at that time, the public relations man told Frank Borman, it is not my place to put words in your mouth. You think of something to say. It's got to come from you.
Good.
And that's changed. That's unfortunately not the case anymore. But then, not only did the NASA public relations people have the courage to do that, but so did the astronauts. And they sat down and they thought about it, and they got in touch with other people. It's a really long, interesting story. But they came up with this, and they did. They came up with the idea of reading the Bible, not to so much promote religion, but to express the American idea of freedom and personal conviction. Because they chose the Old Testament because it is the words that most of the major religions in the world respect. Both Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all respect the Old Testament as part of their basic documents. So by speaking those words, they were trying to reach out to as many people as possible. And they also did it humbly because it wasn't their words. It was someone else's words, maybe God's. But it was words that we don't know who wrote. And it was trying to say to the world, you know, the universe is a bigger place than just
it was dramatic.
Than just what we think or politics. It's a greater thing.
You know, Robert, and I'll always remember because Jim Lovell was part of that Apollo 8 mission. Then he was on Apollo 13, and we almost lost him along with the other two astronauts, Mattingly and Swikert.
Yeah, Jim Lovell's a really interesting guy. I've spoken to him many times. He is unusual in that he actually is a space cadet. He really always wanted to go to space. That was his dream.
We all did when we were kids, didn't we?
We did, but we grew up during the 60s. He wanted to do it beginning in the 40s and 50s, which made him somewhat unusual. Most of the astronauts in the 60s program were jet pilots who loved aviation and flying. Many of them just liked to go fast. But Lovell was unusual. He wanted to go to the stars. And so that made him a very unusual astronaut in that respect.
He's 85 now. Can you believe that?
He's 85. He's still totally pushing the idea of space exploration. He's done a wonderful thing over the many years. And, you know, what's most interesting about the Apollo 8 mission, I like to point this out about Jim Lovell and Apollo 13. What happened on Apollo 13, you know, the Apollo service module blew up. And they used the lunar module as a backup lifeboat. Well, if that had happened on Apollo 8, Jim Lovell would have been dead in 5 minutes because there was no lunar module on Apollo 8. Another story I love to tell.
Yeah, I mean, they were going to the moon on 13.
They were going to the moon. And the decision to go to the moon was made, and they thought the odds were good to go to the moon, even without the lunar module, because they thought the odds were 50-50 of success. They thought those were good odds. And they were willing to take the risk, 50-50, to go to the moon to prove that America and freedom and capitalism could do it better than communism and government. And they proved it right. But think about that. They went to the moon thinking the odds were good at 50-50. Would today's government be willing to take that kind of risk?
Not at all.
No.
Let's take some calls here. Let's go to Keith, Morgantown, West Virginia, Wildcard Line. Hey, Keith, go ahead.
Oh, hello. I really love the show, George. Great, very interesting tonight here.
Thanks.
And I am familiar with the book Genesis.
Thank you.
And I'm very skeptical that we even went to the moon. I'm one of those kind of people.
8% feel the same way you do. I don't, but 8% feel the same way you do.
I sigh with great distress.
Well, let's find out, Bob. Let's find out why Keith doesn't think we went. Go ahead, Keith.
Well, Well, there's several reasons why. I mean, I only have to prove one thing as being impossible, but the Van Allen radiation belt is probably my primary one that I think is...
All right, let's let Bob address that. The Van Allen radiation belt, we've heard this before. We went through it. They didn't die. What happened?
No, they didn't die multiple times. The radiation belt itself doesn't produce a great deal of radiation. You can travel through it, and you're not going to be significantly harmed. Obviously, you don't want to live in it for a period of time.
Yeah, you don't want to hover around it.
Not a big deal. If anything, the Van Allen belts protect us here on Earth from solar radiation. NASA, during the 60s, actually launched four different satellites and put them in four different positions in the solar system so they could watch the sun to see if there'd be any real strong solar flares or the sun's activity was somewhat monitored before any mission flew. And that was a factor before they would fly anything. But I will tell you, too, that if a major solar flare had occurred during a mission, that we were fortunate it never did, but if it did happen, it would not have just killed the astronauts 1, 2, 3. They would have been able to continue. They would have completed their mission. They would have been fine. It would have posed maybe some health risks decades later. It wasn't. The dosages are not something for a short 2-week mission like this. The dosages are not enough to kill you right there and then. Like, for example, being caught in the Chernobyl radiation situation. In this case, no, this would not have done it. The Van Allen belt and the radiation from the sun is not enough to have prevented a 2-3 week mission to the moon. It wouldn't have made any real difference.
Does it bother you that 7-8% of the American public? They do not believe we went to the moon?
Well, I got to tell you, I've spoken to a lot of astronauts. I've spoken to a lot of astronauts' wives. When I wrote Genesis, I made it a point to speak to the wives because I wanted to get their perspective. They're home watching their husbands risk their lives. I spoke to their kids. I also spoke to a lot of astronaut widows. And I got to tell you, it personally offends me when people say that because they're basically insulting and denigrating the memories of those individuals that were willing to sacrifice their lives so this could happen. There were three astronauts that were killed on the Apollo 1 launch pad in 67 in a fire. And they were Gus Grissom, Ed Chaffee, and Ed White and Roger Chaffee put their lives on the line, and they sacrificed their lives so that other astronauts could get to the moon. And it's disturbing to me that people are willing to denigrate that memory. The other thing, too, George, is that for the United States, the lunar landings are one of the greatest achievements our nation has ever done. Why would one want to make believe we as a nation were not capable?
I think one of the things that could have happened, too, Bob, and I'm a staunch believer we went to the moon, but, and I know enough astronauts as you do to know we went to the moon, but I have a feeling that when they did those simulated pictures and videos and films, I think some of those got mixed up with the real stuff. What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you, there is a very funny YouTube, it's funny YouTube video, it's funny if you understand the context, in which a bunch of guys actually videotaped, attempted to recreate the moment in which Neil Armstrong is stepping out onto the moon. But then in the video recreation, just as he does it, they have a light of a light stand fall over as if it's in a movie stand, and it so it breaks the moment, and we got to reshoot, and that's very funny. But the truth of the matter is that we did this. It was a great achievement. Proud of it, and we shouldn't be afraid to be proud of it. It's a great thing, and people died to make it happen.
Well, the Soviets never denied that we didn't go.
Oh, absolutely. The Soviets knew right away. In fact, Apollo 8 basically won the space race because shortly after that mission, they basically gave up any attempts to get a lunar mission around the moon. They gave up. They realized they had already lost that race. They'd have to go do something else instead. But they recognized without question that we had achieved it, just as they had achieved great things in the 60s as well. You know, their secrecy tended to make it difficult in the 60s to know exactly what happened. But the Soviet Union's fallen, and we have all the documents. We know what really went on. And they really did achieve great things during the 60s. And, in fact, some of the things the Soviets did were beyond dangerous in their efforts to keep ahead of us. and their courage in doing those things should not be denigrated. It should be honored and applauded. They did magnificent things.
Can you imagine the things we've witnessed in our lifetime, Bob? You know, a lot of people, a lot of younger people listening to the show right now, never had that opportunity to see that. But I mean, we were alive when John Kennedy was assassinated. We were alive when men landed on the moon. We were there during history.
Well, that's true, John, but you know what? I'm sorry, not John, George. I'm getting my people confused. But George, we were there, but you know what? History will be made in the future, and I am greatly jealous of future generations that are going to see our solar system colonized and settled, and people living on the moon and on the asteroids and in colonies in orbit around the sun and eventually going to the stars. I actually am envious of young people today. The young people today that know we went and don't want to denigrate that memory and have courage and want to do great things, they're the ones that are going to make it possible for new ideas to develop, new companies and new innovations that will make it possible for humans to journey to the stars. And I envy them, and I also applaud them, and I say go for it as much energy as possible.
Birmingham, Alabama, we go east. Jeff's with us. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hey, now, well, frankly, if it's been up to me, Bart Sibrel will be tied up to a static sentence. I'd light up an F1 A on him. But, you know, the thing that gets me mad at some of these guys, you know, frankly, I'm really fed up with SLS bashers drinking Elon Musk Kool-Aid. Long before this Senate was seated, there have been shoulder-drive heavy-lift advocates calling for ALS, NLS, and Magnum. And it's the anti-heavy-lift advocates that held us back, wasting money on RLV fantasies like Venture Star or Skyline. And all Golden Spike's going to do, and the other alt-dot spacer frauds, they're just going to get someone killed. I mean, first they bash government on Go Fever, and then their lord, Simberg, talks safety is not an option. I mean, frankly, if we wouldn't have an Apollo 8 if it wasn't for Marshall Space Flight Center, and I think the SLS folks need to be given more respect. That's all I have to say.
There you go, Bob. Only you could answer that.
I have to say that I do disagree with the caller. I respect him. I must emphasize this. I am absolutely against the space launch system that NASA's building. I said it earlier in the show. I think it's not so much that I have absolutely great respect for the engineers at NASA at the Marshall Space Flight Center. These are great people with brilliant minds who can do great stuff. But it's not their fault that I don't think SLS will fly. It's because it's a creature of politics, and the politics makes it, one, too expensive. They can't cut costs. They can't reduce their labor force. It's just overwhelmingly expensive. And because of the politics, they can't structure the program efficiently to do intelligent things. They've got to shape it for what the politicians want, which sometimes has no common sense or logic. That's not to denigrate the engineers. That's to talk about the failure of the politics. It's one of the reasons I want to get the space program out of the hands of the politicians, have it private enterprise, because then the only focus is how can you do it efficiently and make money at it. Now, the caller also said that these private companies are going to get someone killed. Well, you know what? He's right. But so did NASA, got people killed. This is dangerous stuff. We are not anywhere near or aviation is today, where it's totally routine and safe. This is exploration. This is pushing the envelope. You know, I like to give the analogy, George. In the 1850s, the clipper ship was the epitome of the sailing ship. After 5,000 years of human technological development, we had come up with the clipper ship. It was the greatest sailing ship ever created. But when that sailing ship was flying and crossing the oceans in the 1850s, they normally nonchalantly expected to lose 5% of every ship. Think about that.
Well, I think the Apollo mission was just miraculous. In as much as even with Apollo 1, that should not have happened. We almost went through that mission, going to the moon, with no fatalities.
That's right. And I will say this, that accidents are going to happen and people are going to die, and that is not a reason to say no to anything. The government program will kill people just like the private program. My goal here is to develop innovation and competition so that we have new ideas that's going to make the systems more robust and eventually safer more than anything else.
Robert, we've got links for you on your website, behindtheblack.com. That's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And again, his book, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8, now in ebook form. You can find that too at his website.